3. The biohazard suits were uncomfortable as hell, and the worst part, in Trini's opinion, was that there was nowhere to put a gun. She waved her Sig Sauer P320 around in the air near her hip, flapping her lips inaudibly behind the glass of her facepiece. Hiro just looked at her, still puzzled by these soldiers and their inexperience with the very sort of event they'd been sent to investigate. She tapped the buttons on the side of the helmet, and her voice crackled in Trini's headset. "Use the radio, please." Trini fumbled on the side of her head until she found the right button and pressed it. "Doesn't this goddamn thing have a pocket?" Outside Kiwakura, they had changed into Level A hazmat suits, which were fully encapsulating chemical entry suits with self-contained breathing apparatuses. They also wore steel-toed boots with shafts on the outside of the suit and specially selected chemical-resistant gloves. And no, there were no pockets, which would sort of defeat the purpose of the whole thing, providing both a nook and a cranny for God knows what to write home with you. Hiro decided a simple no would suffice to answer Trini's grumpy question. Trini had sucked down 3 cigarettes in quick succession after they'd landed. She'd been on a Nicorette and the new nicotine patch for the entire flight, and she was wound tighter than the inside of a golf ball. Best to keep one's distance, Hiro decided. Roberto turned and looked behind them at the vast expanse of desert they had just crossed. Their jeep had kicked up a massive fantail of dust, and the prevailing winds were blowing their way, which meant a few hundred kilometers worth of sediment was airborne and swirling toward them. "Better get started while we can still see," he said. They turned and started the walk into town. They'd parked half a mile away, and the going was slow in the suits, but they could see the structures that dotted the horizon from here. Kiwakura was a collection of one-story buildings, a dozen at the most, unpainted, a patchwork of colors coming from the cast-off wood and scrap particle board that had been given to the residents by the Resettlement Commission. As far as planned communities went, it didn't show much planning. Just a main street, structures on either side of it, and a few outbuildings that had been thrown up later, possibly by latecomers who preferred a bit of space between themselves and their neighbors. The first odd thing they saw, about 50 yards outside of town, was a suitcase. It sat in the middle of the road, packed and closed and waiting patiently, as if expecting a ride to the airport. There was no one and nothing else around it. They looked at one another, then went to it. They stood around the suitcase, staring at it, as if expecting it to reveal its history and intentions. It did not. Trini moved on, holding the gun in front of her. They reached the first building, and as they came around the front of it, they saw this one had only 3 walls, not 4, built that way on purpose for maximum airflow in the intensely arid environment. They paused and looked inside, the way you look into a dollhouse. There were cutaway areas, a kitchen, a bedroom, a bathroom, that room had a door, and another tiny bedroom at the far end of the structure. In the kitchen, there was food on the table, buzzing with flies, but there were no people. Roberto looked around. Where is everybody? That was the question. Trini backed away into the street again, turning in cautious semicircles, scanning the place. Cars are still here. They followed her gaze. There were cars, all right, just about 1 per driveway, a jeep or a motorcycle or pickup or old sedan. However the residents had managed to get where they were going, they hadn't driven. They continued on, past what might have been a playground, more or less in the center of town. An old metal swing creaked on its chain, blowing in the wind that now swept the desert sand and dust into town ahead of it. Roberto turned and squinted into the coming clouds. The sand ticked against the glass of his faceplate, and it was hard not to blink, though of course he didn't need to. Another 30 yards and they reached the other side of town. The front door to the biggest house was ajar, and Trini pushed it open the rest of the way, using the barrel of the Sig Sauer. Roberto gestured to Hiro to wait on the porch, and he and Trini stepped inside, one after the other, in a practice maneuver. Hiro waited in front, watching their movements through the open door and the dirty front window. They searched the place, room by room, Trini always in the lead, gun in hand. Roberto was the more thorough, and perhaps the more cautious of the two, moving carefully and steadily and never facing in the same direction for too long. Hiro admired the grace and ease with which he moved, even in the cumbersome suit. But she also knew there was nothing to fear in there. Everything about Kirakura so far suggested a ghost town. She was sure of their result before Trini came out a few minutes later and announced it. 14 houses, 12 vehicles, 0 residents. Roberto put his hands on his hips, relaxing his guard a bit. What the actual fuck? That was when Hiro saw what they'd come for. There, at the far end of town, in front of one of the best kept of the very modest houses, was a silver metal tank, its finish recently polished to a bright and reflective shine. I don't think that's from here. They walked toward the tank, wary. The wind swirled harder, and the dust in the air billowed around the houses, rearing up in columns in front of them before dust-deviling back to the ground in a corkscrew and moving on. It was getting hard to see. Stop here. Hiro held a hand out when they were still 10 feet from the tank. She scanned the ground around them as best she could in the billowing sand, then continued on, searching the ground carefully before she placed each step. Walk in my footsteps. They did, following her in single file, careful to place their feet directly into her boot prints as they went. Hiro reached the tank and squatted down. She saw the fungal covering immediately, but only because of her practiced eye. An untrained observer wouldn't have perceived anything more than a greenish patch on the rounded surface of the tank, a bit like oxidized copper. The tank wasn't in pristine condition anyway. It had made an uncontrolled re-entry into Earth's atmosphere, after all. That's going to put a few dents in anything. But to Hiro, the unremarkable greenish patch read like a semaphore. Trini looked around them, still with her gun at the ready, just in case. She took a few steps toward the house, watching where she walked. She stopped, studying the building, which wasn't very different from the other ones. But there was one thing she noticed. The car. An old Dodge Dart, it was parked at an odd angle to the house, its hood pushed almost right up against a porch pillar. The porch had a low-slung, corrugated roof that bent down at an angle, and from where the car was parked, it wasn't a very big step up from the hood to the roof. Trini looked up, thinking. Back at the silver tank, Hiro bent down, pulling her sample case around in front of her. She clicked it open, snapped out a 20x magnifying lens, and squeezed it to activate the LED lights around the edge of the beveled glass. Through the lens, she got a closer look at the fungus. It was alive, all right, and florid, visibly seething even at this magnification. She leaned as close as she dared, looking for active fragmentation. There was movement there, and she wished like hell she had a more powerful magnifier, but 20 power was the most the field kit carried, which meant she had to get closer still. She looked back over her shoulder at Roberto. Slide your hand through the loop in the suit between my shoulder blades. Roberto looked down. There was a tight, vertical flap of fabric sewn into the back of the suit, a handle of sorts, with just enough space to get his fingers through. He did as she asked. Now hold on tight, she said. I'll pull against you, but don't let me go. If I start to fall, give me a hard pull back. Don't be shy about it. Don't let me touch it. You got it. He held on tight. Hiro braced her feet just short of the tank, about a foot away from it, and leaned forward, putting the magnifying glass and her mask as close to the surface of the middle of the tank as she possibly could. Roberto hadn't expected her to have quite as much confidence in him as she apparently did, and he swayed a little as she let her weight fall forward. But he was strong and recovered quickly, resetting his feet and holding her steady. The faceplate of Hiro's helmet moved to within 3 inches of the surface of the tank. She switched the lens to max magnification and close focus and flicked the LEDs to their brightest setting. She gasped. Through the lens, even at this minimal magnification, she could clearly see fruiting bodies sprouting off the mycelium, stalks with a capsule at the top swelling at their seams with ready-to-spread spores. The mycelium's growth was so fast it was visible. Jesus Christ. Roberto couldn't see around her bulky suit and the curiosity was killing him. What is it? Hiro couldn't tear her eyes away. I don't know, but it's huge and it's fast. And heterotrophic. It's got to be pulling carbon and energy out of everything it touches. Otherwise, there's no way it... She trailed off, staring at something intently. No way what? Hiro didn't answer. She was fascinated by one of the fruiting bodies. Its capsule was bloating beneath the lens, ballooning up off the surface of the tank. This is the most aggressive sporing rate I've ever. With a sharp pop, the entire fruiting body burst, and the lens of the magnifying glass was flecked with microscopic bits of goo. Hiro shouted and involuntarily lurched backward away from the tank. She was more startled than frightened, but lost her balance for a moment and threw her right foot out to the side to steady herself. Her boot squished through something soft before finding solid ground next to the tank, but it was too little, too late. She was past the tipping point and on her way down, right into whatever she'd just stepped in. She watched as the ground moved up toward her in slow motion. And then she was moving upward again. With one strong, controlled tug on the loop at the back of her suit, Roberto pulled her onto her feet next to him. She looked up at him, grateful. He smiled. Careful. A voice called from nearby. Hey! They turned. Trini was standing on the roof of the house about 10 feet above them. I found Uncle. It wasn't much of a climb, even in the suits. First under the hood of the car, then one big step up under the porch roof, then a sort of jump with a shoulder roll, and they were all the way up. Roberto went last so he could give Hiro a shove up onto the roof if needed, and he was so preoccupied with making sure she didn't fall that he failed to notice the sole of her boot, even when it passed within a foot of his face. He would have had to be pretty eagle-eyed to see it anyway because there wasn't much of the stuff, but it was there. Near the heel, between the fourth and fifth hard rubber corrugated ridges of her right boot, there was a smear of green fungus she'd picked up when she lost her balance back at the tank. Hiro scrambled the rest of the way over the edge of the roof. Roberto flipped himself up to join her, and they walked a few paces over to where Trini stood looking down at something. The wind and dust had picked up substantially, so her view was partially obscured, but Trini knew a human corpse when she saw one. This one was in rough shape. Uncle couldn't have been dead for all that long, but the damage to his corpse was extensive, and it wasn't post-mortem. The flesh wasn't mangled from the outside by scavengers or weather. He exploded, Hiro said. Boy, did he ever. What used to be Uncle was now a husk that had been turned inside out, everything internal made external. His ribcage was wrenched open, cleanly and violently at his sternum, parted like a suit coat lying on the floor with nobody in it. His arms and legs were denuded of flesh, their bones pockmarked with what looked like more tiny explosions from within, and the plates of his skull had been split apart along their 8 seams as if the glue that held him together suddenly failed all at once. Roberto, who had seen a lot of ugly things, had never seen anything like this. He turned away, and as he did so, the wind let up, the dust cleared for a moment, and all at once he had an unimpeded view looking back the way they'd come. Every building in town was more or less the same height, and from up here on top of Uncle's house, he could see onto all the other rooftops. Oh my God. The others turned and saw what he saw. The rooftops were covered with dead bodies. Every single one of them burst open in the same way as Uncle's. Roberto didn't need to count to know there would be 26. At the moment they stood on the roof, piecing together what had happened to the residents of the doomed village, the fungus was busily at work between the corrugated rubber ridges of Dr. Hiro Martin's right boot. Cordyceps novus had reached a barrier, the hard rubber sole between the boot and her foot, and if there was one thing it hated, it was a barrier. But every good villain has a henchman. In its mutated state, the fungus housed an endosymbiont, an organism that lived within its body in a mutualistic relationship. What the fungus couldn't do, the endosymbiont could. In this case, catalyze the synthesis of random chemicals in a special new structure in order to break through barriers. It was like having your own chemistry set. The endosymbiont, which lived on the surface of the fungus in the form of a light sheen, was exposed to the atmosphere every time Hiro took a step. It absorbed as much oxygen as it could, combined it with carbon drawn from the dust and dirt particles that had stuck to the goo, and formed a tight network of carbon-oxygen double bonds. These carbonyl groups, now active ketones, pushed their way upward, toward the soul itself, until stopped there by the hard, unyielding mass. So it hybridized again, The new ketone sampled available elements from the rubber and dirt and dust and cycled quickly through a variety of carbon skeletons. It mutated into oxaloacetate, which is great if you want to metabolize sugar, but no use getting through the sole of a boot. Undaunted, it mutated again into cyclohexanone, which would have been good for making nylons, and then into tetracycline, superb if you're fighting pneumonia. And then, finally, and most damagingly, it recomposed itself as H2FSBF6, fluoroantimonic acid. The powerful industrial corrosive began eating its way through the rubber bottom of Hero's boot. The mutation process so far had taken just under 90 seconds. Hero, of course, was unaware of what was happening. As they climbed down from the roof and hurried back to the tank, she was distracted, trying to explain what they had just seen. The fungus, she speculated, was mimicking the reproductive pattern of Ophiocordyceps, a genus that consisted of about 140 different species, each one of which reproduced by colonizing a different insect. How's it do that? Trini had her gun out again and her head was on a swivel as they climbed down onto the roof of the car. Hero explained, let's say its target species is an ant. The ant walks along the forest floor and it passes over a tiny spore of the fungus. The spore adheres to the ant, digs through its outer shell, and nests inside it. It moves through the body as quickly as it can, making its way to the ant's brain, where the rich nutrients send it into an exponential growth phase, helping it reproduce up to 10 times as fast as it would in any other part of the body. It spreads into every portion of the brain until it controls movement, reflex, impulse, and to the extent that an ant can think, thoughts. Even though the ant is still technically alive, it's been hijacked by the invader to serve its needs. She jumped to the ground. And the only thing a fungus needs is to make more fungus. Roberto looked around, understanding the town better now. Or the people, anyway. Jesus, the people. All of them. Hero walked quickly to the tank and knelt down beside it, flipping open her sample case again. The ant stops acting for itself. All it knows is it has to move. Up. It climbs the nearest stalk of grass, clamps its jaws down as hard as it can, and waits. For what? Trini asked. Until the fungus overfills the body cavity and it explodes. Roberto looked up at the roofs of the houses and shivered. That's why they climbed, to spread the fungus as far as they could. Hero nodded. It's a treeless wasteland. The roof was the highest spot they could find. You work with what you got. Her gloved hands picked carefully through the sharp metal tools in the case. She picked a flat-bladed instrument with a ring grip, slipped it over her right index finger, and flipped open a sample tube with her left hand. Carefully, she scraped as much of the fungus into the tube as she could. It's an extremely active parasitic growth, but that's about all we'll know until I can isolate the proteins with liquid chromatography and sequence its DNA. Roberto stared as she flipped the tube shut with a practiced gesture. You're bringing it back? She looked up at him, not understanding. What else am I supposed to do? Leave it! We've got to burn this place. Go right ahead, she said, but we need to take a sample with us. Trini looked at Roberto. She's right. You know she's right. What's the matter with you? Roberto didn't get scared very often, but suddenly he was thinking about his little boy and about the possibility that he might never see him again. He'd heard having a kid could do that to you, make you tentative, aware that you served some purpose larger than yourself. To hell with the rest of the world, I make my own people now and I have to protect them. Nothing else mattered. Then there was Annie. I have a wife, a woman I love completely, whom I was this close to betraying, and I would like very much to get back and get a head start on making that up to her for the rest of our lives. That's what was the matter with him. That's what he was thinking. But he said none of it. Instead, he said, for Christ's sake, Trini, it has an R1 rate of 1-to-1. Everyone who came in contact with it is dead, every single person. The secondary attack rate is 100%. Generation time is immediate, and the incubation rate is, we don't know, but less than 24 hours, that's for goddamn sure. You want to bring that back into civilization? We've never seen a bioweapon with anything remotely close to this kind of lethality. Which is exactly why it has to be tanked and studied. Come on, man, you know that. This place won't stay a secret, and if we don't bring it back, somebody else will come get it. Maybe somebody who works for the other side. It was a valid debate, And while they carried on with it, the corrosive inside Hero's boot heel continued to work with single-minded purpose. The fluoroantimonic acid had proven to be just the thing for eating through hard-soled rubber, but it wasn't so much digging a hole as changing the chemical composition of the boot itself as it went along. Minor mutations occurred almost in a spirit of experimentation as the strength of the boot's chemical bonds varied. The substance was a nifty adapter, zipping through most of the benzene group till it found the exact compound it was looking for. Finally, it reached the other side of the sole, evolving out onto the surface of the inner boot just beneath the arch of Hero's right foot. Benzene X, it had hybridized so many times at this point that it defied classification according to current known chemical compounds, had opened a door for the fungus, which was so much larger in molecular size, to pass through to the interior of Hero's suit, which is where Cordyceps novus found nirvana. The boot, like the rest of the hazmat suit, was loose-fitting, designed to encourage air circulation to prevent the wearer from overheating. The breathing apparatus contained a small fan for oxygen recirculation, which meant a fresh supply of O2 was continually moving through the inside of the suit. Strands of grateful fungus spun off into whispery tendrils and went airborne, drifting upward on a rising column of warm CO2 until they landed lightly on the bare skin of Hero's right leg. Still unaware of the enemy invasion going on inside her suit, Hero screwed the top onto the sample tube, broke a seal on its side, and the tube hissed, a tiny pellet of nitrogen flash-freezing it until it could be reopened in a lab and stored permanently in liquid nitrogen. She dropped the tube back into the foam-padded slot in the case, clicked it shut, and stood up. Done. The debate over what to do next had been resolved the way it always was, which is to say that Trini prevailed. She heard Roberto's arguments, let them go a little bit past the point she felt was necessary, given the difference in their ranks, then looked directly at her friend, lowered her voice a tone or two, and just said one word. Major. The conversation was over. Trini was the officer in charge, and the advice of the scientific escort was on her side. The outcome had never been in doubt, but Roberto had felt a humanitarian urge to object anyway. What if, just this once, they did what was obvious and right, even if it was directly contrary to procedure? What if? But they'd never find out, and in the end, Roberto settled on a secondary assurance. They would take one sample, one, carefully sealed in the biohazard tube, and would not leave Western Australia until the two respective governments had agreed to drop an overkill load of oil-based incendiary bombs on the place. Anything would suffice, even old M69s or M47s loaded with white phosphorus would do the job. There was nothing left to save here anyway. They left town and walked back toward the Jeep.